Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will be. Of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we do hope that you'll hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us one of my favorite guests, Don Scott. And Don Scott is up in Canada. He's a retired school teacher. He's a high school teacher. He's, of course, the president of a medical foundation, Common Cause, as I remember. But he's really doing everything he can to investigate some of the diseases that are plaguing mankind. And where most people... Dan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we do hope that you'll hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us one of my favorite guests, Don Scott. And Don Scott is up in Canada. He's a retired school teacher. He's a high school teacher. He's, of course, the president of a medical foundation, Common Cause, as I remember. But he's really doing everything he can to investigate some of the diseases that are plaguing mankind. And where most people, when they retire, they just go off and enjoy life and play golf. Don got started dealing with chronic fatigue syndrome, and once he realized that the chronic fatigue syndrome that plagues so many people, and of course everything is being done by the Centers for Disease Control not to reveal the cause of this disease, but to conceal it, and then of course leads to many of the other new diseases that are plaguing mankind. Why, of course, he's dedicated himself to getting the truth out. He publishes the Journal of Degenerative Disease, and we're going to be talking this evening already about the avian flu epidemic. I think what's most difficult for the average individual to realize, to accept, is that there really are evil people in the world, that some of these work in the health field, and there really are diseases that are actually created. Where did AIDS come from? You know, AIDS is not simply one disease. It's about eight different diseases. There are eight different types and subtypes of the HIV virus. And, of course, HIV alone does not produce the disease. You have to have a mycoplasm with this. If you don't, why you don't get the devastating effect of AIDS? And why would you get eight diseases all across the world that have maintained their integrity, for what, well over 20 years now, 25 years? Where did they all come from? And where did chronic fatigue come from? And where did Lyme disease come from? And where did Ebola come from? And where did Marburg disease come from? And where did SARS come from? And where did Nipah come from? And are there really people who would create diseases to kill people? Well, with that as a background, Don Scott, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
And I've just been really enjoying reading your Journal of a Degenerative Disease here, and it has so much information in it, and I always learn as we go through your material, and then we have an opportunity to talk. So I'm going to let you start out and start telling the people why you're concerned about the avian flu pandemic. After all, you know, we keep being told over and over again that there's an avian flu pandemic, and they're telling us the truth. There is an avian flu pandemic, but it's a bird disease. It is primarily affecting birds. A few people have died that have come in close contact with the disease. But the chance that this would spontaneously begin going from person to person is pretty small, unless this is going to be used to depopulate large segments of the world. So people say that couldn't happen, but then, of course, they've never read what Jacques Cousteau said in November 1991 issue of UNESCO Courier about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. And how could that be covered up? Why, very simply, they control the media. Or they've never been to Alberton, Georgia, and see the Georgia Guidestones and the inscriptions that talk about limiting the world population to 500 million in constant balance with nature. How could they do that without killing off over 90% of the world's population? We'll be right back here in just a moment with Don Scott. Well, Don, you pick up the story.
All right, thank you. And it begins with the hoopla that is being spread by the major media of the Western world, and in fact all around the world, I gather, from the taglines on many stories we see, that hoopla about the so-called avian flu. Influenza that derives from birds, and the birds have a particular type of influenza bug, which is called the H5N1 species. And our Common Cause Medical Research Foundation thought that we should spend some time in a very concentrated study of just what all of this hocus pocus was about. So I and my son Bill and other members of our foundation who are volunteer researchers, they're very well qualified professional people. One gentleman, in fact, was nominated for the Nobel Prize not too long ago. A member of our foundation, we decided to take a very careful look at all of the background to this so-called pending pandemic of avian flu. And we actually started off rather accepting the stuff that was being drumbeat into the minds of people all over the world. But it didn't take us very long before we realized, when we went back through the documentation we had, which went way back into the late 1940s and into the 50s and 60s, to realize that, hey, wait a minute. All of the people who had been involved in the development of the AIDS cofactors, the mycoplasma you speak of, which lowers the human immune system and makes a victim subject to a retrovirus which never affected humans before, and a retrovirus which was derived from sheep in Iceland by Dr. Sigurdsson, we realized that the people who were beating the drum so loudly about the prospects of avian flu were the same people who had been doing the work in the early days.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back here. Well, our guest is Don Scott, and he's simply talking about how the Common Cause Foundation got involved in looking into the background of avian flu. And one of the things that, of course, John had done was to go back and study when the creation of the AIDS virus. And what people don't understand is the American government, and working with our intelligence agencies, had recruited a number of scientists, and they were working on how to create new diseases and new cancer-causing diseases and new devastating diseases. And they published a number of secret publications, the Special Virus Cancer Project, and they were tried to really destroy all of these, but some of them survived, and Don got hold of them. And actually, I have copies of a couple of them myself. I've gotten through Don. But, you know, here you have people who have actually been working with the HIV, creating the mycoplasm, and this is a genetically modified mycoplasm, and literally all of the people who have AIDS also have not only HIV, but they have the mycoplasm infection too. And then as they begin looking at the avian flu and all the talk about avian flu, they begin to realize it was the same people. Is that right, Don?
Yes, that is right, Dr. Stan. And to give you an example, we started off by not only reading the medical documents from peer-reviewed journals and the government documents that were available to us from various sources, some documents being ones which the government had originally published, and the government of the United States had originally published, and then managed to lose track of. I've told the story before, but it's, I think, worth repeating. When we were doing our study on the development of the AIDS cofactors, we came upon a document called the Special Virus Cancer Program Progress Report Number 8. And since that time, we've got number 9, number 10, number 12, number 13, 14, and 15. But when we got number 8, I had a phone call from member of the administration of the United States Senate. And this lady phoned me up, and she said, I had a couple of senators into my office who told me that they understood you had a copy of the Special Virus Cancer Program Progress Report Number 8. And I said, yes, I do have. And she said, well, my goodness, we've searched the archives of Washington, and we can't find that anywhere. And I said, oh, well, I said, that's probably to be explained by the fact that a lot of them were destroyed following the Watergate scandal. And she said, well, would it be possible for you to send us a copy of this report? And I said, yes, I will be happy to do that. So I photocopied all roughly 400 pages and sent it off to the United States Senate. Now, here was a very unique situation, a very dramatic illustration of how some of these documents and things that were going on went down the Orwellian memory hole. Those who know the novel by George Orwell, the novel 1984, will recall the memory hole where documents, historical documents, which reflected badly on the current government's line, as it were, on a whole variety of subjects. They had people hired to go through the textbooks and newspapers, and whenever they came upon an embarrassing reference, they put that reference down a memory hole, which dropped it into a gas-fed inferno where it was all burnt to a crisp and theoretically was disappearing from the world.
But I think it's so important for our listeners to understand that the government had to destroy these. I mean, they were initially distributed, but then they had to destroy them all because they could never let the American people realize that created a new disease that so far has killed 500,000 Americans, 1 million more infected, 30 million dead throughout the world, another 50 million infected and going to die, and the number increasing infections every day. They cannot let the American people know that, and so what do? They destroy the evidence. They're organized evil. And fortunately, they didn't do a very good job, and Don did get copies of these. Did you ever get any recognition from government for sending them a copy of the government records that they were trying to destroy?
No, I never got a reply from them. And it was entertaining to realize that the United States government had to phone a retired teacher in Sudbury, Canada, to ask for a United States government document. But I sent it off to them, heard no more from them, but they at least had the document in their hands. And since that time, a great number of people have had access to it, because lots of people such as Dr. Leonard Horowitz and others have made copies, and including our foundation have made copies and sent it to those who wanted to actually see the documents for themselves. And some of the startling statements that occur in them, dealing with health and with things like cancer and so on. So we went back over all of these documents that we had, and we began fitting the pieces together and realized, my goodness, these people who were engaged in the early days of the AIDS cofactor research and development. Now, when they set out, they didn't know they were going to develop AIDS, but they were looking for disease agents which they could rest assured would be pretty fatal. And they found that in the form of the mycoplasma, which could be engineered. And they actually did engineer it, and they actually did get a patent. The brazen quality of these people, the United States government holds a patent on death. They have the patent, which you make available to your listeners, I know, on the mycoplasma, the pathogenic mycoplasma.
And, of course, you actually reproduced a copy of the page of that patent in your latest issue of the Journal of Degenerative Disease.
Yes, and we include a micrograph, 100-and-some-thousand times multiplied increased in the size, provided to us by an eminent doctor of microbiology, Dr. Harold Clark, formerly of the George Washington University in Washington, of course. Dr. Clark is probably the preeminent, or one of the top 10 preeminent authorities on the mycoplasma, and Dr. Clark provided us with a photograph of this mycoplasma, and that's included in our latest issue of the journal as well. So here we were looking through the literature on viruses dealing with influenza, and the names of the people that we had come upon and very dramatic roles they were playing in the era leading up to the smallpox vaccinations in Africa, which really unleashed the AIDS virus cofactors. These people were in the story of influenza that we were studying, and in addition to the documents, scientific documents, peer-reviewed, reproducible scientific research that we were using, and the government documents that we were using, we also went to a certain amount of secondary literature, because we had to see what was being said there, and we came upon the study by Gina Colatta, a science writer for the New York Times, and she wrote a book called Flu, the story of the great influenza pandemic of 1918 and the search for the virus that caused it. So we read through Gina Colatta's book, We were interested to discover that she had a great amount of very favorable comment about a Dr. Robert Couch. Well, that's fine. And she also had a very strange note of thanks at the end of her book, thanking a Dr. Robert Shannock for all the help he had given her, but nowhere in her index does she indicate Shannock at all. So we wondered, well, what's the great help that he gave her that she acknowledges but doesn't use? And then we realized from our study of the AIDS cofactors that we had been studying a number of years ago a document written by the two doctors that Gina Colatta was so grateful to, Doctors Couch and Shannock. And we went back to their research, and we reproduced the title page of their article, which goes way back to 1962, and that title page dealt with, of all things, the mycoplasma. And yet we found that in Gina Colatta's book on influenza, even though the people she owed the most to, Couch and Shannock, nowhere in her book did she mention mycoplasma.
Okay, we're going to be back in just a moment with John Scott. You see, it's almost, it's like a whodunit. But you have to understand there are people working behind the scenes who have a different agenda because they worship a different God. They have a different objective and they believe, well, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Don Scott. And unfortunately, as we begin talking about these things, most people find it very difficult to believe that there could be a population control agenda, that people would launch wars simply to kill people and create devastation, that people would create new diseases to create devastation, that there really are people who would like to dramatically decrease the number of people in the world. And if you haven't read my Population Control Agenda monograph, which is available on our website, incidentally, you need to go there and get the information and understand there are people who are very outspoken, people like Bertrand Russell, talking about how wonderful it would be if we could just have a black plague sweep the earth every generation, and then we wouldn't have to worry about birth control so much. That's page 103 of his book, The Impact of Science on Society. If you'd like to get the documentation for what we say, pages from the UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, where Jacques Cousteau talks about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. How could you suppress something like that? That should totally discredit Jacques Cousteau. Imagine what would happen if Pat Robertson said something like that. Why, you'd see that brought up in every journal and every newspaper and every magazine and every television and radio station. But of course Jacques Cousteau could talk about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day and not a word in the general media. So pick up the story there, Don.
Yes, well, we had identified Doctors Couch and Shannock as being very important in this study of flu written by Gina Colatta. But there was one thing that struck us was rather strange. Even though she said that Dr. Shannock had proved to be so very, very, very valuable to her, she spelled the name with two N's instead of one. Now that sounds like a trivial point. Everybody can just forget about it and go home. But we couldn't forget about it, because if you put into any computer search engine and ask for information on a Shannock spelled with two N's, you're not going to get the information that's stored there of a Shannock with one N. And we wondered, is this just a mistake by Gina Colatta, a New York Times writer who must be very, very, very careful, we're sure, in her sources and her spelling, and she has editors who will be going over this and proofreaders and all the rest of it. So we phoned Gina Colatta up, and she didn't answer our phone. We got her voicemail. Gina Colatta, I'm either away from my desk or out on assignment. Leave your name and number, and I'll get back to you. Well, we left her name and number. Oh, yeah, she wanted a brief message of what we were calling about, and I said that I was calling because she referred to a Dr. Shannock, and I wanted to know if he was a Dr. Shannock who had worked with Dr. Couch to write an article about Mycoplasma pneumoniae, which produces flu-like illness, and I hung up, and I didn't hear from her for a couple of weeks, so I phoned her again. And I said, I left an earlier message. Would you get back to me about your thanks to Shannock and Couch? I want to find out what Couch gave you that was so important and why you spell his name differently. I want to know if it's the same guy. No answer. Actually, I left four messages with Dr. or with Gina Collada, and she hasn't answered yet. Now, the whole thing is so complex.
Hold that thought right there, Don. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Don Scott, and he's simply pointing out that there was a Couch and Dr. Couch and Dr. Shannock, and they had written many, many years ago articles on this Mycoplasma pneumonia. Now, you have to understand that when we talk about influenza, about 25% of influenza is actually caused by a mycoplasm. We all refer to it as a viral disease, but you really can't tell, what is actually causing it, but they know in large studies that a significant part of the influenza we have today is not viral, but mycoplasma in its origin. And what's so important about this is they have been working, our military has been working on using mycoplasma as a biological warfare agent for many decades. In fact, much of this work was originally done in Hitler's Germany, and we brought those nice Nazis over here to continue their work, at least according to Dr. Nicholson, and he's been told this by people who have been working in these biological warfare laboratories. And of course, they're afraid to come forward for fear of their lives, but they have actually talked to him, and so he even refers to some of that in his book, which we carry, entitled Project Daylily. But you picked the story up there, Don.
Yes, well, when I did get an answer from Gina Collada, and maybe she'll hear this interview, and she might decide to find out who I am and why I'm leaving messages on her voicemail, I realized that the failure of Gina Collada to even mention the word mycoplasma, when her two sources, the most important sources, Couch and Shannock, had years ago been developing a mycoplasma and had been using it in tests on prisoners in Huntsville Penitentiary in Texas, and that the diseases that seemed to stem from their work with the mycoplasma spread out as quote-unquote mystery illnesses in the Huntsville district. A whole string of people on one street, for example, whose breadwinner worked at the prison where these infections were being planted in the prisoners, developed ALS. Now, this is so dramatic to have an epidemic of ALS, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. But doctors Couch and Shannock had written this article way back when.
No, did they ever admit that they were involved in the experiments there at Huntsville?
Oh, yes. They have now admitted it. In fact, they say that in their article that they conducted these tests on volunteers, but then our research demonstrates beyond a doubt, and they acknowledge it themselves, that these volunteers were the prisoners in Huntsville Penitentiary who, in return for allowing themselves to be injected with a mycoplasma, little did these poor people, some of them with grade 2 and grade 3 education, holding out their arm and allowing Couch and Shannock to put this stuff into them, but they have acknowledged in much of the literature that it was prisoners in Huntsville that they were infecting. So we turned back then to the article that they had written back in the 60s about the Mycoplasma pneumoniae, and then other things began to fit together. We found that they were raising the mycoplasma on the ground-up kidneys of monkeys, of rhesus monkeys. Now, they say that in their article. They took rhesus monkeys, sacrificed them, removed their kidneys, ground them up into a mash, and put the mycoplasma pneumoniae into the culture and let it grow. And then they were able to extract fluid from this growth on the monkey kidneys and inject it into the prisoners.
But, of course, isn't that how you get the simian virus, the cancer-producing virus? Isn't that what they did with the polio vaccine? And that's how they contaminated most of our population with the cancer-producing virus, the SV40?
Yes, indeed. It turned out that the rhesus monkeys they were using carried the simian virus 40, which is known to cause cancers in human beings, and they grew the polio vaccine on these kidneys as well. So that they knew that millions of Americans who had taken the early polio shots would, years later, down the line, 10, 15, 20 years later, would begin to present with cancers. And the dramatic growth of cancers subsequent to that is evidence that what happened was a fulfillment of what they were doing.
And we actually have the book, The Virus and the Vaccine. We actually have reference to a book actually published by the National Institute of Health that tells the story and about the researcher who found out, her name was by Bernice Eddy, she found out that there was a cancer-producing virus in the vaccine. You know what they did? They destroyed her career. I wonder why.
Yes, they were very angry at her.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Don Scott. And Don, pick up the story.
All right. Now, in their article, doctors Couch and Shannock refer to the monkey kidneys as MK. And they were getting the monkeys from a monkey farm. I forget which one it was initially, but they were using so many of them back in the late 50s and early 60s that the United States government established a monkey farm in Covington, Louisiana, just outside of New Orleans, and they began raising rhesus monkeys in the Delta Primate Laboratory. Now get that. They were using monkey kidneys, MK, and they were developing the monkeys or breeding the monkeys at Delta Primate Agency, MK Delta. And this took us back to the research we had been doing on MK Delta in developing the AIDS virus. MK for monkey kidney and Delta for rhesus monkeys bred in Covington, Louisiana. And we had to then go back and start fitting the other pieces into what was emerging. And what emerged was this. It was discovered accidentally discovered by Dr. Robert Huebner a few years before Couch and Shannock were working with the monkey kidneys from Delta Primate Farm. Dr. Huebner had been trying to find out on behalf of the United States Navy why so many naval recruits developed pneumonia. And they had a say in their literature various places, well, look, if these people were spread out all over their hometowns and farms and everything they came from, they wouldn't be getting pneumonia with the frequency that they're getting it when they're a Navy recruit. Well, what makes the difference? Well, the difference is that a farm boy coming in from the farm after working all day and going to bed, he's got his window open, he's got his window shut, it doesn't matter. There's a movement of air, there's a change of air regularly going on. But what happens when he's in the barracks and there's 200 other young men?
Hold that thought right there, Don. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and then Don Scott is basically talking about these experiments that were being done, you know, these diabolical experiments that used in Huntsville, and then began to talk about how a doctor was assigned the job of trying to determine why so many Army recruits were coming down with pneumonia. Young men coming into the military, I guess, perhaps into the Navy, and they were getting pneumonia. And you would never see that in the general population. And so this doctor began thinking that maybe it had something to do with the crowding, the fact that they would have a lot of young men together in a barracks, rebreathing the air that was breathed by others, and pick the story up there, Don.
All right. Well, Dr. Huebner got a number of these young men with the pneumonia that they developed in their barracks. And he was studying under the microscope and using other techniques available to him, where is this pneumonia coming from? And they identified a rather strange organism, infinitely small, and they didn't know the name of it when they first saw it, but they called it a pleural pneumonia organism, PPO, pleural pneumonia organism. And they didn't realize it, but they were discovering what doctors Nocard and I forget the other gentleman's name in the Pasteur Institute in France had discovered at the end of the 1800s, they were looking at the mycoplasma. They didn't know it at the time, and it wasn't until a few years later that Dr. Huebner was told by others in the know that, hey, look, this pleural pneumonia organism is actually a mycoplasma, and the mycoplasma is actually a fragment of the DNA of a bacteria. Now, there are a whole range of bacteria, and the possibilities of a mycoplasma coming from any one of these was there, because the DNA is the agent, or the, what shall we say, the messenger of life. It is the part of this single-celled animal called a bacteria that it literally says, I want to keep living. So when the bacteria is killed, some particle of the DNA or the RNA finds its way into a host cell where it can be made at home and continue to live. Then Dr. Huebner was following up on the pneumonia, and he discovered something else. A very significant number of the young men who developed pneumonia from this pleural pneumonia organism also developed diseased adenoids. Now, the adenoid, of course, is a lymphatic cells in the nasal passage where you breathe in air, and the air goes by the adenoids, and the adenoids kind of monitor what's going into the lungs via the nasal passage. And he found that the adenoids, when they were exposed for a sufficiently long period of time, well, whatever that was, weeks or months, would begin to, quote-unquote, spontaneously degenerate. The cells would begin to fall apart. And when the pleural pneumonia organism went by the adenoids would begin their process of spontaneous degeneration. And so he called that disease agent, he added another word to it. Instead of just pleural pneumonia organism, he talked about a pleural pneumonia-like organism, PPLO. And then he was told, hey, wait a minute, that's not a PPLO or an Eaton agent, as others called it. That is a mycoplasma. And that's where Dr. Couch and Chinook come in. They start breeding the mycoplasma on the kidneys of rhesus monkeys. And they were doing work comparable to the work being done at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia by Dr. Hilary Koprowski. Now, Dr. Hilary Koprowski, he wasn't breeding mycoplasma on rhesus monkey kidneys, he was breeding it on kidneys of chimpanzees. Now, where would you get enough chimpanzees in the United States? Well, you wouldn't. So what happened? Lo and behold, the government of Belgium, for some reason, said, hey, Dr. Hilary Koprowski, we will help you establish a big farm at Camp Lindy in the Belgian Congo. And you can have all the chimpanzees you want, and you can take these chimpanzees from time to time and kill them and mash up their kidneys, and you can grow various kinds of disease organism on them. Well, he said, and we have no reason to doubt it because the evidence is substantiated, he said, well, I'm going to grow an organism that causes polio, and then we will vaccinate mostly a bunch of black people in the Belgian Congo with this vaccine to see if they can be protected against polio. The Belgian government then established in Belgium a laboratory where they would develop their own vaccines based upon the kidneys of chimpanzees. And then something else began to happen. There was a vaccine development project undertaken in New Orleans at Tulane University by Dr. Alton Ochsner. And they were using the kidneys of rhesus monkeys in Tulane, and the Wistar, they were using chimpanzees. And it was apparent that they had something pretty dangerous here. They had going on monkey kidneys, whether the monkeys were chimps or whether they were rhesus or whatever, they had something that would, A, cause influenza-like illnesses, would, B, lower or actually destroy the immune system of the victim, and C, could cause the degeneration of cells in the brain and in the heart and other places. And at that time, now this was the very early stages, at that time there was a change of government from Harry Truman to Dwight D. Eisenhower. And Dwight D. Eisenhower put somebody into his cabinet in a role of the Assistant Secretary of Health. That was Nelson Rockefeller. And Nelson Rockefeller was one of the members of the Rockefeller apparatus, I call it, who, along with others in that financial upper layer of humanity in the United States, he was at the National Institutes for Health in Washington and the Centers for Disease Control. He was in charge of them. And he did a great amount of work, but most of which is shrouded in secrecy. And to establish his work, he created what he called a war room. And then, after a certain number of months with the public health agencies in the United States, Nelson Rockefeller then resigned from that position and was appointed by Eisenhower as the head of the CIA, Eisenhower's personal representative. And Eisenhower asked for a personal representative and said he needed one because he was learning of so many evil things going on, which he said he could not lie to the public about. He said, I can't lie, so the best thing to do is don't tell me about it. Go ahead and do it. So here we have Nelson Rockefeller from 1952 to 1960 at the head of, first of all, the health agencies, militarizing those with his quote-unquote war room, and we've got all kinds of documentation about this, and then in the CIA, and in the CIA, it was under Rockefeller that they established the MK Ultra, MK Delta, and MK Naomi programs, secret programs, And they were moving along with people like Couch and Shannock and Huebner and Robert Gallo and a whole bunch of others. And then suddenly, bang, John F. Kennedy was elected president. And John F. Kennedy would not ever have tolerated any of this if he knew it was going on. He was shot dead in broad daylight in the center of a big American city, and the crime has never been investigated by the U.S. government. They appointed the so-called Warren Commission, but when you look at who was on the Warren Commission, you realize that they had the crooks investigating the crooks. And he was shot dead on November 22nd, 1963, and he was succeeded by Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson, it turns out, had been working all along with McNamara, who was a great member of the Rockefeller apparat. He succeeded to the office of president, and he immediately began doing certain things. For example, Kennedy had been planning to start withdrawing troops from Vietnam. And the very day after the shooting of the president, that program of withdrawal was altered by Johnson so that the troops stayed in Vietnam and were later increased. But here then, we moved into another area. These things have a political background. You know, Dr. Shannock and Dr. Couch don't get money from the Pentagon and don't get money from NIH and from CDC and these organizations or these institutions without earning it from them. And it was in 1964, May 1964, just shortly after, well, 6 months after the death of President Kennedy, whose presence had put a damper on the work that had been going on. Kennedy was killed. Johnson succeeded him. 6 months later, Johnson was making a speech in May 1964 at Ann Arbor University, and he departed from his written speech to make this very strange statement. Now, this statement is reproduced in a book called Battling Wall Street by Professor Donald Gibson of the United States. And Johnson said, apropos nothing he had said before, and as Gibson says, he made the following mysterious remark. And here's what Johnson said. Within your lifetime, powerful forces already loosed will take us towards a way of life beyond the realm of our experience, almost beyond the bounds of our imagination. Now we ask ourselves, what are these powerful forces that have been loosed? And we, for a long time we didn't know. And then we realized from the virus cancer program, number 14, there is a document reproduced on page 4 of that document, which shows that in the early months of 1964, just prior to Lyndon Johnson's peculiar remark about powerful forces already loosed. That sounds like letting a wild animal loose. In 1964, Johnson authorized the creation of a viral program. Now, they didn't call it the special virus program at that time, but they just called it a viral program. And even though it was sprang into being in 1964, there were 30 people appointed to work right away, and 4,926 contracts were let. Now, this is in a government document. And then the next year, they changed part of the program name from Virus Project to Special Virus Leukemia Project. And, of course, the mycoplasma is very, very closely or importantly or significantly involved in leukemias. And they went from 4,000 contracts the year before to 8,723 contracts overnight.
Now, of course, these are contracts with scientists to carry out these macabre experiments.
Yes, they were supposed to be studying leukemia. But then when Nixon came into power, the name suddenly changed. It wasn't leukemia that they were studying, it was cancer, and he declared this great, in quotation marks, war on cancer. But the thing is that their first report was numbered 8. It wasn't numbered 1 or 2 or 3, it was numbered 8. Where were the other 7 reports prior to 1968 for the progress report number 68? So we then went to the other progress reports, and we learned that there was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Hayflick at the very outset of the program in 1964 established by Lyndon Johnson. Dr. Leonard Hayflick was given a job of establishing, quote, a central mycoplasma laboratory. And that is on page 255 of the Special Virus Cancer Program, Progress Report number 8. Way back then, the U.S. government established that program. Now, who is Hayflick? There we came to another astounding coincidence. Hayflick was a colleague of Kaprowski of the Wistar Institute, who was growing various disease agents on gorilla, on chimpanzee kidneys, monkey kidneys. And Hayflick also worked with Couch and with Shannock on the mycoplasma. All of the pieces began fitting together, and all growing out of the fact that we were taking a much closer look at influenza, and the people who had background information and who were treated by people like Gina Colata as quote-unquote experts.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Don Scott. And basically what Don is saying is the fact that they've been working on creating pathological mycoplasm to create an influenza-like illness. And they've been working on it, well, at least for 40, if not many more years. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Don, pick the story up. We've got 3 more minutes in this hour, and then, of course, we'll hope you can be with us the next hour. I really want to explore this in much more detail, but you've got about 3 minutes here before we go to the next break.
All right. Well, Drs. Shannock, Couch, Hayflick, Huebner, they were all involved in the programs which ultimately came to be called the Special Virus Cancer Program, but had to do more with the mycoplasma. And then comes the dramatic other evidence. Practically no doctor has heard anything about the mycoplasma except a brief reference here and there to mycoplasma pneumoniae and so on, and they're told it's a innocuous disease agent, or mycoplasma permanens, don't worry about it. And we have now documents from the United States Army Medical University which demonstrates their interest in and study of the mycoplasma. But the universities that teach medicine to doctors for civilian population don't have these units on the mycoplasma. Why is that?
Well, of course, we did learn about 1980, I think, that there is an atypical pneumonia, and a certain number of those, about 25% of them, would be mycoplasma. That was really my first contact with it. You know, here I was almost 50 years out, 30 years out of medical school, and when I first began hearing about this atypical pneumonia caused by mycoplasma, ordinarily would respond to antibiotics. So pick up the story there, Don.
Yes, and the atypical pneumonia caused by different types of the mycoplasma, by the way, but no reference made to the general population through their general medical practitioners about what an actually very dangerous agent, death agent, this was. And then we realized that for some reason or other, this so-called avian flu was being hoopla'd worldwide by the World Health Organization, which, as people will know if they study the history of the WHO and so on, is dominated by the Rockefeller apparatus and its population control people. They are the ones who are now pushing the dangers of this quote-unquote avian flu. And it then became apparent to us that in our Journal of Degenerative Diseases, we had to point out all of the contradictions in what they were projecting.
Now, hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening has been Don Scott, and this is a fascinating insight. You really will want to find out more about his a Journal of Degenerative Disease. Don, how can people get in touch with you and get a copy of your journal?
Well, I would prefer they write to me.
All right, fine.
But or phone. If they want to phone, it's area code 705-670-0180. And I will give them the details if they phone that number. We're on Eastern Standard Time, so don't phone me at 3 in the morning, our time. Or write to me at Box 133, Station B, as in Bob, Sudbury, Canada, P as in Peter, 3, E as in Edward, 4N5, Don Scott, Box 133, Station B, Sudbury, that's spelled Sudbury, Canada, P3E4N5, and we will share our special report with you.
Oh, hold on. Okay, fine. We'll talk a little bit more in the next hour, but right now, of course, I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty programs are listener-supported. If you think that you're going to hear things here that you will not hear elsewhere, if you agree with me that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, if you believe that there really are evil people out there who do have a different agenda, who promote wars and disease and famines and yes, they even can modify the weather, and if you doubt that, we have a notation from Zygmunt Brzezinski's book in 1970. Written, it's called Between Two Ages, where he talks about how, you know, in the future, they're going to be able to make storms and create droughts. And, of course, also create chronic diseases. But, as he says, most people don't need to worry about it or need to know about it. Very few people need to know. They really have been creating diseases. They've known how to do it for a long time. If you'd like that page out of the book, we'd be glad to get you a copy of the page or the notation at the bottom where Brzezinski says this sort of thing. You have to understand that people who dream a different dream, who have a different outlook, they're an elite, and they look upon us common folks as simply fodder to be used for their experiments. And there are pretty too many of us anyway. We're using up the world's natural resources, and it would be better off if there were not so many people. If you doubt what I'm saying, let me suggest my talk. It's called Planned Population Reduction. Planned Population Reduction. A talk I gave back at the Prophecy Club here maybe a couple of months ago. If you'd like more information on it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, remember that Don Scott's address is in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. That's Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. You can call us at 1-800-544-8927 if you need Don Scott's address or telephone number. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because, believe me, if this country doesn't turn back to God, we're going to lose America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, who are on the front lines of this battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And so, until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They have to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we ordinarily ask for people to call us, but please don't call unless we do ask for calls. We have with us this evening Don Scott, and Don, of course, works with a specific medical foundation up there in Sudbury, Canada. And he publishes the Journal of Degenerative Disease, and it's a fascinating information that they put out to this organization, and really a number of key physicians and scientists throughout the world are affiliated with Don. He heads the Common Cause, or he is the emeritus leader of the Common Cause Medical Foundation. He's been talking about the avian flu, and back the thing that is so disconcerting is a massive propaganda campaign to frighten us to death about the danger of avian flu. And then Don goes back and talks about a book written by Gina Colata of the New York Times. It's a very fascinating book called Flu. But she talks about a couple of doctors there that were a great source of information to her. But in the book, she never mentions that they had anything to do with the flu. And then, of course, Don goes back into his research into chronic fatigue syndrome and AIDS and finds out that these were people who were working with a mycoplasma back in the 1960s. And they were working, according to Don, in some macabre experiments in Huntsville, Texas, experimenting on the prisoners there and, of course, spreading the disease into the entire community. And those of you who have heard interviews with Dr. Garth Nicholson, formerly a professor at MD Anderson Clinic in Texas, why Dr. Nicholson comments that several of his students had gone on to become pathologists, at least one of them had come on to be a pathologist, and all the prisoners for Huntsville were supposed to be taken to his laboratory, because he was the state medical examiner, to be autopsied. Prisoners were supposed to go to his laboratory. Instead, they were taken to the Army laboratories. And when he began to inquire about it, he suddenly died under very mysterious circumstances. And other people who began looking into this died. A number of people associated with Dr. Garth Nicholson were killed, some of them very, very blatantly, like being shot in the back of the head a number of times. And if you haven't read Dr. Nicholson's book entitled Project Daylily, that's Project Daylily, you really need to get it. A very courageous individual, as is Don. But Don, go ahead with this story. This is the background. Suddenly, we're beginning to find out, as you pointed out, and I've known for many years, because it's occasionally mentioned, that about 25% of the influenza cases are actually coming from a mycoplasma, which is not a virus at all. And then we know about the atypical pneumonia that comes from mycoplasmas. But the government has been weaponizing this for a long period of time to make it increasingly pathological. So pick up the story, Don.
All right, and I was dealing with the fact that there is a political background to the medical phenomena that are characterizing the world health scene today. And I referred to Lyndon Johnson's remarks shortly after assuming the presidency that there were forces already loosed which were going to dramatically change the world, and it would be changes almost beyond belief. And what in heaven's name could that be? What could he be talking about back in 1964? Well, then we turned, and we have to keep doing this, we follow each lead as best we can. We turned to Lyndon Johnson's biography called The Vantage Point, his autobiography.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Don Scott. This is a fascinating story. You won't want to miss any of it. Okay, Don, pick the story up there. And you were talking about Lyndon Johnson's book, The Vantage Point, which I read. Fascinating insight into really who runs the world. But go ahead.
Yes, and on page 340 of that autobiography by Lyndon Johnson, he says this: when I entered office, that would be at the end of 1963, we were investing less than $6 million annually on population control. During my last year in the White House, that investment had grown to $115 million under Johnson. And what was he doing with $115 million, which by today's figures would be in excess of $1 billion a year? What were they doing? And then he goes on to say, I assembled a committee of men and women, now this is Johnson himself writing this, who represented a who's who in population control. Secretary Wilbur Cohen of HU, there we have it, Health, Education, and Welfare, the organization that Nelson Rockefeller had been assistant secretary in, and John D. Rockefeller III were co-chairmen. And he goes on to talk about the great work that these two gentlemen did and how he facilitated it by altering the rules which governed the Agency for International Development, AID. It's kind of a coincidence, AID and AIDS. But what happened immediately after John D. Rockefeller III and Wilbur Cohen began heading up this Population Control Council, the Agency for International Development began a vast vaccination program in Nigeria, and we've got all the details of this, by the way, and the area that they vaccinated, they started off vaccinating the people against measles, and then after Johnson left office and Nixon converted the program into a special virus cancer program, they began work with Lytton Industries developing vaccines to fight smallpox, and they really significantly increased their participation in this great effort. It was decided by the President,
Nixon. Hold that thought for just a moment. We're going to be back here with Don Scott as we talk about their program for population control in Africa. Okay, and of course you can't go into Africa and say, well, we're going to actually want to limit your population. There's just too many black people here. No, you have to go in and say, oh, we're so concerned about you, and we're so concerned about the children, and so we want to help you. And we're here. We're from the World Health Organization and from the United States, and we are really concerned about you. Ladies and gentlemen, in Botswana today, the women going in to be, tested before they have the pregnancy. And Botswana has really a very, very effective public health program there. They have a very, very prosperous country, one of the most prosperous countries in all of Africa, certainly the most prosperous black-controlled country in Africa. In Botswana today, 42% of the pregnant women are HIV infected. They're all going to die. That is either the greatest public health failure of all time, or the most successful genocidal program of modern times. So you would expect with a program that had failed this miserably, how do they modify it to protect the women? They didn't. They're going to continue doing exactly what they've been doing and letting them contract the disease and die. So pick up the story there, Don.
Yes, well, from Nelson Rockefeller in the cabinet of Dwight D. Eisenhower, up until the advent of John Kennedy, whom they had to kill to get out of the way, and then back into the program under Lyndon Johnson, and in Nigeria with the Agency for International Development. Now, we've got all the documentation. You see, the beauty of our position is this. There will be people hear or read about our work, and we will get documents sent to us from people we don't even know, documents that have been up to now secret or unavailable to all kinds of people. And we're able to fit these pieces together. the financial, the pharmaceutical role in the finances is horrendous. The political, because the politicians make it possible for these companies to work with the NIH and other public health agencies, and medical profession at a certain level, and the media, which are essentially bought by the politicians, or pardon me, by the people who are controlling the politicians. And it all fits together. Our study incorporates all of these areas, and it brings us now then to the present drumbeating on the so-called avian flu. Now, it didn't just start with the avian flu drumbeating. For example, we have in our files from June 8, 1997. Now, that's 9 years ago. From Sunday, June 8, 1997, we have a clipping from our local newspaper which says, "New virus claims two more lives." And they talk about a place in Kuala Lumpur. It's a Reuters news agency story, and it says the death toll from a new virus in Malaysia's Borneo has climbed to 19. Now, there's been 70 people in 3 years die of avian flu. And the thing about avian flu is, it is a bird flu, and it is carried not by air, it is carried by from bird to bird by contact with diseased feces, and it is an intestinal disease with the birds, not a respiratory disease. And the young people who are coming down in among these 70 or so that the World Health Organization and the United Nations and the United States government and the Canadian government and certain media are drumbeating about, this is a flu that does not spread to human beings without the human being having been in contact with poultry, diseased poultry, within 3 weeks of becoming ill. Now, how do we know that? Well, there was an outbreak of avian flu, H5N1 species, in Hong Kong back in 1997. And there was a handful of people died, including a child who was autopsied. And the autopsy revealed that he had died not of avian flu, he had died of Reye's syndrome. Now, Reye's syndrome, of course, is a fatal disease for many of the victims who are under the age of 12 or 15 that is caused when these fever-causing viruses are treated with aspirin. It will frequently convert into Reye's syndrome, and they'll die of Reye's syndrome. Well, that's what killed the child in Hong Kong. So Dr. K.G. Fukada, he went to Hong Kong, and he interviewed the families and the doctors and everybody intensively for several months about the avian flu of 1997. And he says in his report that the single most important factor in his research revealed that only people who are in direct contact with diseased birds within 3 weeks of their becoming ill will be infected by avian flu. Now, how many people in Canada and the United States and Great Britain and Germany and so on are going to be coming into contact with live, sick birds 3 weeks and then 3 weeks later come down with this illness? The children, for example, in Turkey, that have died in the last 4 or 5 weeks, three or four of them, they were children whose home raised poultry, but who were bringing the birds into the house at night because of the unseasonably cold weather. And when a bird became ill, they would cut off its head and they would eat it. And the children would be playing with the head of the dead bird, and there would be bird feces on the floor. These are the children with avian flu. So there'd be the chances of a bird flu infecting intestines of birds and carried in the feces, making people in our society ill, is absolutely totally remote. And then another thing that is remote is if one person gets it, he can't pass it on to the next one because he's not going to have feces that's going to be played with by some other child. But there's still this drum beating. Now, why are they beating the drums about avian flu? And this is beginning to be so blatant. For example, on Canada's national television network, they had a television show a couple of weeks ago, or a week and a half ago, called Black Dawn. 2-hour special about what an avian flu pandemic would look like in Canada and United States. And it was an absolutely horrifying fiction. And it was designed to scare people silly so that they would be absolutely panic-stricken and desirous of buying one of the drugs they say will be helpful in alleviating the symptoms, Tamiflu. Well, Tamiflu, in order to become effective, has to be taken 2 tablets a day for 5 days. But on the record, and we have this in our files, and we can quote it to you, and we can show it to you, the study by the United States Centers for Disease Control reveals that in the years 2003 to 2004, the people who died of flu of any stripe, whether avian or otherwise, died within 3 days of becoming ill. Those who died within 3 days. Those who didn't die recovered. But they died within 3 days. Well, if you're dead at the end of 3 days, how do you take the last 2 days of your treatment to get that 5 days in to make a Tamiflu effective? It's just one of the inconsistencies. But why are they doing this drum beating? Well, here is our best conclusion. Now, as I say, all our evidence is reproducible scientific evidence from the best medical journals we can get, and they, of course, are suspect in many cases, and from government documents. The prospect is very, very real that that is the World Health Organization and certain agents of the United States government and of the Canadian government and of the British government know that there is a disease coming down the pipe, as it were, which will induce a flu-like illness which will kill millions of people. Now, this sounds extreme, silly, unbelievable, but who would have thought back in 1981 when Dr. Gottlieb first identified officially the evidence of AIDS in some people in the San Francisco area, who would have thought at that point in 1981 that a few years later 8,000 people a day would be dying? Now, that is roughly the figure. 8,000 people a day are dying of AIDS. And it's ravaging Africa, especially, which got the greatest concentration of United States free smallpox vaccine. And if they can do it once, they can do it again.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Don Scott. And that certainly seems to be, in my mind, a very little question. We know they were working on a disease starting back in 1969, a disease that would destroy the immune system. David MacArthur testified before Congress, asked for $10 million to create a new disease that would destroy the immune system. And he said, some people think we shouldn't produce it because it would lead to mass killing, but we want the money. If you'd like to see his testimony, give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. We'll send it to you. Well, Don, go ahead, pick up the story there.
So, we're not looking at an epidemic of flu. we're looking at a flu-like epidemic. And that flu-like epidemic will be built around the mycoplasma studied by people like Robert Gallo and Dr. Couch and Dr. Shinnok and so on. And it all fits in scientifically and medically with what has been going on and as knowledge is going on in the journals of medicine that are available, but which most doctors actually don't read. I go up to the university library, and I also go up to the library of the large Laurentian Hospital here in Sudbury, where I must say that the librarian is extremely valuable to us. And we get copies of journals with important articles that have been on the shelves of the hospital or the university for 5, 10, 15 years, and there will still be pages which at the edges are stuck together because nobody has ever opened them. And we open them, and we read them, and we study them. And so when people go to their local doctor and say, gosh, I heard this person, Don Scott, talking about mycoplasma, most of the doctors who say, well, you know, it's nothing to be worried about. There's only one kind I know about, and that is mycoplasma pneumoniae, and it only gives a transitory atypical pneumonia and so on. And they don't actually know what we know in terms of the disease agent, the pathogen, because they haven't got the documents we've got, they haven't read those documents, and they haven't fitted it in to the media and to the government and to the money that is behind it all. And, of course, the whole goal of the AIDS epidemic in Africa was set out by Henry Kissinger, arch criminal in the Nixon government, but before that he was involved with the CIA and the Rockefellers in their research into population control. They have this program, staging it into existence, to reduce the population of the world. And we know from all this study that we have done, and I say this quite proudly, we do it for no remuneration. We, none of us, are paid. And we do the research. We're concerned with human beings. We're concerned with human health. We're also concerned with the world problem of population control, but we're inclined to the view that President Kennedy took when he repudiated large nations like the United States and Canada and Britain and Belgium going into underdeveloped countries and controlling the population by the science. Kennedy said, and he said on a number of occasions, and we have the documentation, he said, once these people in these underdeveloped countries can realize that they have a security and they have health and they have job opportunities and they have a fair share of world income, they will limit their own...
Hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking with Don Scott, and Don was talking about this world population control agenda. And, of course, anybody who doubts that there is a planned program needs to get this, the National Security Study Memorandum 200, that's known as NSSM 200. It came out in 74 over the name of Henry Kissinger, but Henry Kissinger is simply an extension of the Rockefeller complex. And this NSSM, an official government document, which was top secret for many years and only declassified in the 1990s, talks about the necessity of controlling the population first in first world countries and then in third world countries, and gives the specific countries how they're going to do it. This is the major thrust of American foreign policy, and why every year now we give over $400 million every year for family planning throughout the world, which is simply another name for population control. And then, of course, Don then steps up back and then points out, you know, is this really what's going on today? Are they planning on creating new diseases to control the world population? And I would like to suggest AIDS is simply one example. We have all sorts of other horrible new diseases which have been created. And this is why so many of the scientists, microbiologists, and suddenly are just dropping over like flies, and they're not suicides at all. When you find somebody stuffed in the trunk of the car, 6 or 7 stab wounds in them, why, this is no accident. And so you have to understand that there are people who know what's going on, and they're afraid to speak out, because if they do, they may end up in the trunk of the car. These things really be going on in America, and I would like to suggest they not only could, they are going on. So pick up there, Don.
Yes, and we have to understand that it starts with money and with greed. And President Kennedy rightfully pointed out that as a family becomes more secure in their prospects, and they don't need the prospects of having 10 children, so hopefully 2 will survive. But if they have 10, all 10 are going to survive. Or they don't need 10 children to provide them with a living when they are no longer able to work themselves, because they have savings and they have various government support programs and so on. So John Kennedy's attitude was, don't talk to me about population control. He said, this is criminal, the idea that we would go in to distant countries and inject ourselves and our values onto them. If they are given the fair opportunity to earn a fair share of the wealth that they're working to generate, then they will limit their own families. Now, you look around today at the modern family, basically 2 children, sometimes 3. It was a number of years ago when there was no thought given to this, that there were larger families, and I must admit that I had not even thought about it when I was able to have 8 beautiful children, of whom I'm extremely proud and happy with. But that was my own personal and my wife's personal attitude towards children. The average family regulates itself. And it's usually 1 child, 2 children, or 3. And we don't have that problem that they have in Africa, where a mother can have maybe 8 or 9 children. Prior to accepting a smallpox vaccine, which did indeed stop the smallpox, but then they became infected, as you have pointed out earlier, with a new disease, AIDS. And I'd like to quote to you something that, for example, David Rockefeller said in a speech to the Bilderberg Association in 1991. That's an association of nations convened to discuss world problems from time to time. And he said at this particular meeting in 1991, and it's quoted in our current journal special, on influenza, we are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings, get that, and respected their promises of discretion for almost 40 years. Get that.
In other words, basically, they were not going to tell the people of the world about this little clique called the Bilderbergers, started in 1953, and I think this last year there was 1 or 2 articles in the general media, but it's totally blacked out because the media is controlled.
Absolutely.
Why is it controlled? Because the people who control the media, and there are only 5 mega corporations who control the media today in the United States, and really a large part throughout the world, they all are aligned with the Bilderbergers. Their job is not to reveal the truth, but to conceal it. Well, go ahead. Pick up the story there, Don.
All right. Now, we have seen from the scientific literature that we quote in our special article that, as you have pointed out, influenza is not only a viral disease. There are types of influenza that are caused by mycoplasma, which are particles of DNA or RNA of bacteria. And there are also bacterial pneumonia, which are instigated when either a viral illness or a mycoplasmal illness lowers their immune system to such a degree that the victim develops pneumonia. Now, actually, when you look at the record, there's practically nobody dies of influenza. They die of the pneumonia. Now, and the pneumonia caused by the mycoplasma pneumoniae, which they were doing all that research, and the United States government established back in 1964 this mycoplasma laboratory with a great friend of Couch and Shannock, Dr. Hayflick, in charge of it. But let's say, okay, well, the average person can't get these documents without a great deal of effort and trouble and thought, but what they can do is go to their local library and or to their local bookstore if they're inclined to spend $35 or $40, and they can buy a book printed by the Johns Hopkins University Medical School. Now, this book is about 1,700 pages, and on the cover they call themselves America's Number One Medical Authority. Get that. America's Number One Medical Authority. And then they say here, renowned for research in health and medicine, John Hopkins partners garners more NIH, National Institutes of Health, grant money than any other university. Now, you'd think, okay, boy, there's that 1,700-page authority, number one medical authority in the United States. I'm going to check up on Don Scott's talk. I'm going to look in here and see what they say about the mycoplasma. Well, let me tell you this. You can turn to the index, look through it, and lo and behold, not a single, reference to mycoplasma. And you wonder, where is it gone? Well, we wondered why there was no reference to mycoplasma in the John Hopkins health book, America's number one medical authority, so we phoned them up. And I got the secretary to Dr. Clegg, the chief editor, and I said, look, I'm wondering, where is the reference to mycoplasma?
Hold that thought right there. In just a moment, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, of course, is Don Scott, and he's commenting that there is a book, and it's referenced in the latest issue of the Journal of Degenerative Disease, to a 1,700-page book put out by the Johns Hopkins Medical Foundation. It says, you know, this is the most authoritative book you're going to find any place, source of information on medicine, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages, said to be the authority. And so, of course, Don goes through the book, and there's no reference to mycoplasma. We know that certainly a quarter of the flu cases in the world today are mycoplasma. A quarter of the pneumonias are mycoplasma. And so Don calls up the secretary and tries to get hold of the editor of this book, this authoritative medical book, most authoritative book in the country on disease, and find out why they don't talk about mycoplasma. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the subject of government experiments to make it more pathological, to make it into a deadly disease. And of course, you find this in all AIDS cases along with HIV. You find this in chronic fatigue. You find this in Gulf War illness. You find it in fibromyalgia. You find it associated with Lyme disease. You find it associated with many of the children with autism. But pick up the story there.
Yes. And the secretary said, well, give me your name and your address, and we'll get back to you, and Dr. Clegg will explain why there's no reference to mycoplasma in America's number one medical authority. Imagine what the number two medical authority is like. And I didn't hear back from him, so I wrote him a letter, and I addressed it to the address that was in the book. it says if you're interested in anything about our most important book and you want to write to us about any part of it, write to us. So I wrote to them, and I said, you haven't answered my phone call, which you were going to do. Would you answer this letter? Where are your references to mycoplasma and to the work of influenza specialist Couch and AIDS specialist Shenock and so on? No answer, and that was about 2 months ago. Now, this is another example of the memory hole, the Orwellian memory hole. Don't tell them anything about the mycoplasma, and therefore the doctors who use America's number one medical authority, so-called, won't know about it if they haven't already some idea about it, and the average citizen will not find anything else about it. But then I went one step further. You see, the mycoplasma is a fragment of a bacterial DNA or RNA. The bacteria dies. It could be killed, for example, by penicillin. And that's why many people with these mycoplasmal illnesses that were treated with penicillin, the disease got worse because more bacteria were killed and more mycoplasma released. So the bacteria that is the most likely from a scientific point of view is a bacteria many thousands of years old called Brucellosis, or Brucella, Bacteria Brucella. And there's one species of Brucella bacteria that's called Brucella abortus. Now, why is it called abortus? Because it induces abortions in pregnant women.
Pregnant women or pregnant cows?
It starts with cows, and it induces abortions in cows. But when a woman, farm wife, for example, contracts the Brucella disease, the important symptom or sign is that if she's pregnant, she will have a premature delivery, and fetus will usually be dead or badly diseased when it's delivered.
Okay, fine. No, that was something I wasn't aware of. I knew it was a disease of cows, but I didn't realize that humans got the... I knew they got it, but I didn't realize, of course, produced the miscarriage. So go ahead. That's fascinating.
Yes. Well, the particle in the Brucella bacterium of Brucella abortus, which causes the cows, the original animal that's infected, the particle which does the damage can be carried in the mycoplasma residue, which is, of course, from the DNA of the bacteria. And therefore, all by itself, it will induce what is known as chronic fatigue syndrome, because it not only induces extreme fatigue, but women who are ill with advanced levels of chronic fatigue syndrome have an extremely difficult time becoming pregnant. And we have several studies which demonstrate that if their mycoplasmal infection is treated, they become pregnant much easier after that treatment. It all actually ties together with another concept which is given in the June 9th, 1969 hearings of Dr. MacArthur before the Congressional Committee, meeting in secret. Now, this is the United States government. My goodness, such evil. He told the congressmen, these men who are elected to Congress to protect the interests of their constituents are meeting in secret. And Dr. MacArthur says to them, essentially we are working on two types of disease, biological disease. One will be fatal, and it will be fatal because it will be refractory to our immune system upon which we depend normally for health. The other agent that he talked about was one which would disable. You're going to have one that will kill and one that will disable. Now, why? Well, you see, Dr. Stan, as you know, you can go to Africa and you can kill 8,000 black people every day of the year without anybody getting excited, including the World Health Organization and the United States government and the Canadian citizens and the American citizens. 8,000 people in Africa died today from AIDS, and 8,000 will die tomorrow. And yet all the drum beating about 70 people dying of avian flu in 3 years. Now, you can't kill 8,000 people a day in Canada and the United States without a tremendous hullabaloo. But you can disable them, and especially if they're women, because you can say, well, that woman's not really sick. She's just sick in the head. She can't stand the competition of modern life. And that is the story that various people have presented in all kinds of popular literature, including the stupid, stupid stories in the New York Times and Time magazine. It was the Time magazine that coined the name Yuppie Flu for victims of this tragic disease called chronic fatigue syndrome. They wanted to disparage the disease in order to discourage research into it. And when Congress said, well, come on now, you have to do some research. They said this to the Centers for Disease Control. And they said to the director, Dr. Mahi, they said, here's $12 million. Get the answer to chronic fatigue syndrome. Well, he did everything else but. And he lost, quote unquote, $4 million of money given to him to the research chronic fatigue syndrome simply disappeared. And then Dr. William Reeves, who worked there and apparently is one of the ones who's honest, he went to the public under the Whistleblowers Protection Act and he said, okay, I've got a press conference here and I want to tell you this. $4 million given to the care of Dr. Brian Mahi, director of the CDC, is missing. And the government had no alternative, since this all went public, to appoint an auditor. And the auditor said yes. After a year of study, Dr. Brian Mahi lost $4 million. Now, why did he lose $4 million? He spent it on other things. He says he can't remember what he spent it on. And that's magazine Science, which, believe me, is one of the media assets for this outfit. Science said he could not account for the money because he's probably just a poor bookkeeper, were words to that effect. And so they didn't fire Dr. Mahi. They transferred him to a job with Homeland Security, and they appointed somebody else into his place.
And I really think it's so interesting that they did everything they could to avoid researching the source and the origin of chronic fatigue syndrome. There's a wonderful book that Don has talked about. It's called Osler's Web by Hillary Johnson. If you haven't ever read it, you need to try to get a copy. I don't think we have any more. We carried it for a time. But Hillary Johnson's book, Osler's Web, is must reading, and you'll see how the CDC did everything they could to avoid doing the research that they'd been told to do by Congress. Because, you see, Congress doesn't really understand, and the people don't understand. We elect our representatives, and they appropriate money, and they tell the executive branch what to do, but they have their own agenda, and it has to do with creating new diseases and disabling our people and destroying their lives and killing a lot of people with the new diseases that we're creating. But we can't let the American people know that the major thrust of so much of our policy is population control. You need to get the National Security Study Memorandum 200 and some of the other material we have here at Radio Liberty, and you begin to catch a glimpse of the degree of evil we're up against. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, it certainly would be, because I have come to the conclusion, Dr. Stan, after very deliberate and thoughtful and humane reflection and the studying of all the evidence, that probably the greatest terrorist nation in the world is the United States of America. That sounds like a terrible thing to say in the light of the fact that we have such marvelous people as yourself and Dr. Harold Clark, a magnificent gentleman. Unfortunately, you're not really represented by your so-called representatives, members of Congress, meeting in secret, discussing the development of biological weapons, one to kill and one to disable.
Now, that, of course, the hearings that were held in 1969, and we do offer a couple of free pages of that, you know, at least going into the fact that Dr. MacArthur was saying, you know, some people say we shouldn't create this new disease because it would be a new means of mass killing, but we want the $10 million, and that was 1969, and 10 years later, he said, take 10 years to produce the disease, and 10 years later, what do you know, we've got the first cases of AIDS.
And simultaneously in 1981, besides the first cases of AIDS, there were the first cases of chronic fatigue. Now, chronic fatigue, from our evidence, is caused by the mycoplasma, which reduces the immune system, but it doesn't introduce a retrovirus such as the Vizsla virus that is a component of AIDS. It is simply the mycoplasmal element which causes extreme fatigue and causes premature delivery of fetuses, limiting population control by disabling women instead of killing them like they kill them in Africa. And tonight on television news, there was a item on CNN about Osama bin Laden. Now, everybody in the United States practically says Osama bin Laden is such a great gangster. But Osama bin Laden has released another audio tape. And on that tape, he says, we're not engaged in this struggle against the United States because we're crazy. We're engaged because of a long history of evil against us and our people. And he said, if you want to know more, get a book by William Blum, B-L-U-M, and it's called Rogue State. Now, here's Osama bin Laden, like Oprah Winfrey, with his book club, and he's pushing a book by Mr. William Blum called Rogue State, and the CNN interviewed Mr. Blum, and they said, how do you feel about Osama bin Laden recommending your book? And he said, well, I'm glad that you get the publicity, because he said, what I've done is go over the history of the United States over the last 50 years and studied the evidence of criminality. There was, for example, a Cuban airliner with 63 people on it, blown up by a CIA agent. My goodness, and the guy, Cuba asked that he be extradited recently, they found out where he was, that he be extradited to Cuba for trial, and the U.S. won't extradite him. They don't like others blowing their planes up, but they don't mind blowing up other planes. And so Mr. Blum said that was what he had written about. How Osama bin Laden got the copy of the book is hard to say, but Osama may, instead of living in a cave in Afghanistan, may actually be living in some kind of palatial residence in Saudi Arabia. Because you have to remember that 12 out of the 14 hijackers on 9/11 were from the United States ally, Saudi Arabia. And one was from their ally in Egypt. And one was from the Syrian-occupied state of Lebanon. There wasn't a single Afghani in that attack, and there wasn't a single Iraqi. But the United States used it as an excuse to invade Afghanistan, and then they used it as an excuse to invade Iraq. And Wolf Blitzer said to Mr. Blum, well, what do you think about the Twin Towers? 3,000 people died in that terrible terrorist act. And Mr. Blum said, oh, yes, but 30,000 Iraqi women and children died in the American attack on Iraq. 10 times as many. And they call Osama bin Laden a terrorist? Who is the terrorist? Who was Dr. MacArthur talking to about a disabling disease and a fatal one? Members of the U.S. Congress. And all of our evidence shows, scientifically, politically, historically, that this avian flu coming down the line is going to take millions of lives, but it won't be an avian flu jumping species.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a minute with Mr. Don Scott. One more time, let's get that address out.
Box 133, Station B, as in Bob, Sudbury,
Ontario, Canada.
Yeah, you can say Ontario, Canada. P3E4N5.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, if you need to get that address, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll get Don's number for you and address. But Don, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program, and I share your concern. I know very well we're being manipulated. I've never seen as much time and effort put into frightening the American people about a threat that is not a threat at all. The chances that this will ever mutate from being an avian pandemic to a human pandemic is, well, it's pretty, pretty small. But they're obviously up to no good, and it could very well be that you're absolutely right, that there is a plan to create a new disease. Now, I thought maybe they would actually genetically modify the avian flu virus to make it much more virulent, so it would go from person to person. But the idea that this could very well have to do with mycoplasm, a different disease, and we wouldn't even suspect it, would we?
No, you would not expect it. And we have scientific research literature, for example, where Jack Maniloff, who edited the most important textbook on the mycoplasma, simply titled Mycoplasma, Maniloff talks about the mycoplasma functioning as an entree for viruses into the human body. The body will resist avian flu because it's a bird virus, not a human virus, and it won't be transferred from man to man or man to woman or whatever because it is not a human virus. But if the individual is infected with a mycoplasma, then the mycoplasma can act more or less as a carrier of the virus in. So it might be a slightly modified avian virus, or it might be the regular H5N1, but we're already infected to such a huge degree by mycoplasmal infections that don't show because our immune system is keeping them down and the rest of it. But after a certain period of time, the immune system will be challenged beyond its capacity, and then a so-called avian flu will start decimating 50, 60, 70 million people. And everybody will say, well, you know, the good old U.S. government and the World Health Organization and all the media flacks tried to warn us, but we didn't do enough.
Hey, we're out of time, Don. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great evening, and I hope I can get you on again sometime real soon.
Well, thank you, Doctor.
Good night, and God bless you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Don is very, very critical of the United States, but with good reason. You see, we have to understand that there have always been two forces in the United States. One was the Christian, the righteous, the good, the wholesome. I mean, these were the people who created this country, who fought for this country, who wanted to establish a utopian society based upon Christianity here, where people were good and you could limit the power of government. That's what it was all about. But what very, very few people have told you is at the same time that we fought our Revolutionary War, there were already forces here that have been here probably for well over 100 years, almost 150 years, and they were part of secret societies. They were Rosicrucians, and then after 1717, there were Masons who were into the occult and into the dark arts and into these ideas of the ancient mystery religions about creating a one-world government under the control of a ruling elite. And so you've had two parallel forces working in America today. Did you know that the architecture of the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., is laid out in occult lines? We have a book, HarperCollins' book, called The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. It's all laid out in occult lines. Do you remember when Hillary Clinton invited Jean Houston to come into the White House and conjure up the spirits of Mahatma Gandhi and Eleanor Roosevelt? Conjure up? Yeah, actually, this woman would be tapping into the supernatural, and Hillary invited her to the White House, and everybody laughed. But then, not to be certainly favoring just one political party, why Nancy Reagan was deeply involved in the occult as well. Remember, she was into astrology and getting advice for her husband, Ronald Reagan, from the astrologers. We have this battle against evil at the highest levels of our government. Our society is riddled with people who worship a different God, who have tapped into the other dimension, and that is the spiritual dimension. We see it exemplified every Monday evening on NBC in the program The Medium, where this woman taps into the other dimension. This is not imaginary. If you read the Bible, you'll read about it repeatedly, but we're told to avoid witchcraft, to avoid mediums, to avoid diviners, to avoid those who tap into the other dimension. You see, we're pretty involved in the spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Oh, there are demonic forces within our society, and of course they are intent upon killing off large parts of the world's population. People say, oh, I don't want to believe that. Well, but it is true, and you better find out. You better check and try to prove it's wrong. Let me suggest you go to my website, RadioLiberty.com. You can pull down free of charge our Population Control Agenda monograph. Of course, the book written by Professor Garth Nicholson, Project Daylily, my talk on planned population reduction. There's so much information out there. You get Don Scott's information. Check it out. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle. And so until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.